than trying to inch up the minimum wage from 5 1/4 to 5.75 or 6.25 or whatever, to start working at the other end and start saying, look, if you're going to get the benefits of the tax breaks we've given business in recent year, you've got an obligation to society to make sure the people you are putting out there get that kind of money. What about tax policy? Washington State, I don't know about Oregon, Washington State has no income tax, I believe. Minnesota, one of our three primary taxes is the income tax, and ours is, they keep saying, wildly progressive. We have had three brackets, 8.5, 8%, and 6% tax brackets. So if you make $3 million a year, you pay 8.5%. If you make $15,000, you pay 6%. And so, yes, you pay a higher percentage of your income in state income taxes, but you factor in property taxes, you factor in sales taxes, highly regressive taxes, and you find out that our tax burden is about the average Minnesotan making $10,000 a year is paying like 17% to 20% of their income in taxes, total state and local taxes. You get down to the $30,000-$40,000 income, they're paying about 10%. You get down to the wealthiest 1% and they're paying about 9% in total state and local taxes. Our tax system, editorial boards of the papers have said, oh, we've got a far more progressive tax system than other states. I've written responses before pointing out that we don't have a progressive tax system at all. Ours is less regressive than other states. And states like Washington with no income tax, all the taxes are regressive, and therefore people who make less income are going to be paying not only, they will be paying less in total dollars, obviously, but they're paying a higher portion of their income to do so. And some would say, well, that's okay, that's just fine. But again, that's counter to what I think is a compact that most Americans overwhelmingly support, that if you're working, you should be able to afford your health care and you should be afford some basic necessities of life that many people cannot. In top of the tax regressivity we have, we also provide lots of little tax subsidies. I won't mention things like home mortgages that renters don't benefit from, but take a look at employees, generally executives, how many things they get tax income tax free income. Business account, if you get entertainment through your company, if you get food and so on, usually not lunch bucket type of meals, but restaurant type of meals, paid for out of the corporate expense account. None of that, you don't deduct it because you don't pay it. It's a tax exempt income that you are receiving because the working person who's working in the factory, they may not, in Minnesota, you don't pay sales tax on the food, you get the groceries, but nevertheless, you're using income taxed money in order to do that. And so the tax system is far more regressive when you factor in those things than even we think of it otherwise. If we're going to address these, which I would argue we ought to be doing, certainly there's a role for things like consumer education. I guess I would think I can probably live on less money than a lot of poor people could because I know something about efficiency in purchasing. I remember working 20 years ago when I was in college trying to get our state to put unit pricing in grocery stores so you can figure out the cost of cereal and other products per ounce or whatever. Very valuable techniques for consumers, but look how many people who are low income don't have those advantages. So I think one thing government can do better and our schools can do better is teach people you don't have to buy something because advertisements tell you you want it and that this brand is better. We can help people, we can help reduce some of the disparity by consumer education. But fundamentally, government can do it in several ways. One is a more progressive tax system. Taxes based on ability to pay is something that at the federal level, certain people talking about flat taxes or getting rid of income tax and replacing it with a national sales tax, if you want to see the disparity in incomes grow far faster than it's been growing, you'd put that in place. But progressive tax code, requirements that jobs pay living wages, we're not trying to guarantee everybody's wealthy. I don't think you could do that. I think what you can do is guarantee that people who are working have at least a decent, whether you call it minimum wage or living wage or whatever, an income that's sufficient to meet these needs. And finally, stepping in and filling in the gap with government social services or private charities. And some people say it's private charities' role. Until the 1930s, it was. And why did government step in? Because the charities had not met that need. Government and charities together are not meeting that need now. And we still, that will probably always be part of the picture, because people with surprising, unexpected health needs and other things are going to be down and out on their luck at times. But for us to be wholesale supplementing the income of low wages, I think is unfortunate. And I'm hoping that we can open this up now into a discussion of the whole concept of what you think government should be doing, and how we build political will if we should be doing more than this, because I happen to think that social compact that we've never lived up to is a valuable one. In our country, one more thing, expanding it to an international level, our country not only has set that as a social compact here, but 50 years ago, last December, we signed, it was not part of the UN initial charter, but the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which says that we believe, as do most countries of the world, we believe that every citizen of the planet has a right to adequate food, shelter, health care, opportunity for a decent education. It's a powerful list of rights that we believe are innate human rights that governments have an obligation to address. And our country has put that into, we've said we believe that, and yet we haven't practice it. We have not lived up our commitments, not only here at home, but our commitments as part of the global situation, which is why the Jubilee 2000 effort that we've been talking about this week is so important, to address debt in other countries that takes away their ability to meet the basic human needs. But with that, I'd like to open it up to discussion of this in terms of where government should fit in here, how we should address these things, and frankly, if you don't think government should be doing any of that, say so that too. Yes, Susan.
What are the strongest arguments? What prevents getting the living wage passed so that it is a living wage? Why is that?
What's the other side of the argument?
What's the other side of that, and then how would we on the side who want to have a living wage counter that argument?
Okay. Basically, it's private business. Government shouldn't be telling business how to function. The market will determine things. And the people who have the people who run the businesses will fight tooth and nail against it. A couple years ago, some woman in Minnesota when they were talking about higher minimum wage, she said, I understand how, she says, my boss would tell you that this will put a heavy burden on him if he has to pay a higher wage. And he said he may not be able to afford his second home. And she's talking about, I'm not able to afford my rent. And he may not be able to afford his fancy car, and I can't afford the new generator on my car. And a powerful statement on what she was going through as a waitress in his restaurant and what this all meant. We don't have the votes to raise the minimum wage by 50 cents an hour right now, and our governor said he doesn't support minimum wage increases or minimum wages, period. I have never figured out quite what they think people ought to do. They'll say, well, they ought to get a better education, get ahead. I don't know how they expect people to do it, and I think when you see the people who work who really work hard for business for 10, 15 years, and then they get laid off through corporate merger or downsizing or whatever. It's not that they weren't doing exactly what they were asked to do and that they weren't the perfect employee. It's just that forces beyond their control dump them on the street, and some people, one of the predominant political philosophies in elective office these days is that it's not government's role to do that. And of course, then they don't want to subsidize it either with childcare or anything else. I don't know. I strongly disagree with that philosophy, but that's what gets there. And I've noticed when you talk minimum wages, people are very leery of voting against it because they know it's highly popular. But again, raising it by 25, 50 cents an hour isn't, I certainly supported that because it's better than nothing, but we shouldn't think we've done enough after that.
Early in this century, John Ryan calculated what he called the living wage, which was, I think, enough to support a family of four, the idea being that in any household, some adult could be at home with kids. It was assumed then that it was the mother, but it wouldn't be now. And a colleague of mine calculated what that the equivalent of that would have been in the early 90s. And this would have been enough for adequate food, appropriate housing, enough clothing, adequate medical and dental care. Pretty much the basics with a little bit left over to go to the movies and things. And it would have taken almost, I think it was almost $40,000. 35 or, you know. And if we're talking about raising minimum wage to a living wage, if that's what we call a living wage, which most of us would want to live at that level, I think, and would want to see others live at that level, I think that's why people are afraid to talk about it. Because when you think about how much per hour that is, lot more than minimum wage.
Yeah, but I think the group, one of the groups in Minnesota that's been pushing for living wage is talking more like $11, $12 an hour.
Right.
For, and again, you can come up with any kind of number to justify whatever, but trying to suggest that you're going to have one person support four people and do it there, I think some people would say at that point, well, maybe what we should do is say we're going to assume one person can support two kids and so on. And addressing child care needs, our economy, our government, and our society have not addressed the fact that whereas at one point 90% of women stayed home with young kids, and now it's far less than half. And we assume that child care, oh yeah, well, we can put a little bit of money into affordable child care. But when you see what it costs to do it, if you have two kids and you're a $5, $6, $7 an hour person, it doesn't pay to work. And yet, as we want to get people off welfare, the expectation is they should work. And therefore, if the direction is we want to make sure people are working and working outside of the house, means you have to provide some child care for kids. And I frankly think that it makes good sense to subsidize some child care, but we have to recognize it's not just, oh, a little thing like, well, we subsidize this or that, so we'll put a few bucks into this too. Child care is the biggest single expense of a lot of households.
Compounded by the fact that most child care workers make $5, $6, $7 mm-hmm. an hour, and if we're going to pay them $12 an hour, that's going to double the cost of the child care.
And in Minnesota, the single best thing we've seen happening in the last few years, in 94, when I was running for governor, I talked about funding our sliding fee child care program, which would have been about $100 million. So on, my opponent, the incumbent, said it was really outrageous, and a year later he came in and actually provided a significant boost in that direction. I was really pleased. I think he recognized that that was about the time welfare reform changes from federal level were coming in, and he realized you can't really afford to work if you can't have child care. But if you think how backwards the system is, we had this year our largest county, we had a child care supervisor for the county childcare subsidy program, came in and testified how they wanted to make sure, they wanted to try and get an exception to our welfare reform law, because under the law, in order to get affordable childcare, the sliding fee where your subsidy is based on how much you make, the more you make, the less your subsidy. She wanted to try and change the law because right now, if you lose your job, you go on welfare, you serve on welfare for 6 months, job training, whatever you need, and then you move off of it into the transition, then you get affordable child care. However, if you are not on welfare, in that county there's a 2-year wait to get the subsidy for child care because there's a waiting list because we don't have the money for it. And so they found a lot of women who, usually women, who couldn't afford to work because they couldn't afford any child care. So they quit their jobs, go on welfare, have 6 costly months, and then they could start out and get child care, then get their job back. This woman's suggestion, which was the nuttiest idea in the world, but better than what we do now, was, why should we waste 6 months of all these welfare costs when we could just turn around the next day and put on that? So why don't we require only 1 day on welfare before you could do this, which is kind of bureaucratic way of thinking. Here's the problem, here's the solution to it. And frankly, she knew a lot better than that. She knew you couldn't get us to decide to fund the child care. So her compromise was to say, well, why don't you quit your job, go on welfare for 1 day, and then the next day you can get your child care, and then you can go out and search out a new job, and maybe you can get rehired where you quit, because you really have to quit in order to go on welfare in order to get the subsidy. Now, that's backwards, but we don't want to do that. And why, I haven't figured out. I keep thinking it makes better use of the economy if we can put people to work. I think people in our society have different skills and different strengths, but 20 years ago we took people with disabilities and we thought we ought to pity them, and they've been saying for a lot longer than 20 years, don't pity us, give us a chance to participate. And very few people, even with severe mental and physical handicaps, cannot contribute in some way to society. And we should be putting the people to work where they can fit in. And our system doesn't do that and doesn't account for it. So, over.
It's interesting, you know, we talked about minimum wage and everything. And if you really look at it, you talk to many of the smaller employers, to hold a good individual who is dedicated to your business and wants to work, you end up paying well more than the minimum wage. And the minimum wage, per se, in many areas, is way behind what some people
what are reality is.
So it's really not right. Other than the back-breaking labor that, you know, many Mexicans come up and do in the farm labor. Here again, we could do it, but too many of us are too daggum lazy to get over and bend and do that kind of work. And so we force those people to work, in this case, you know, in many cases, in minimum wage.
And you're right, right now when the economy is going strong and there's low unemployment, minimum wage becomes pretty meaningless because you have to pay, fast food jobs have to pay much more than that in order to attract people, though that doesn't always last that way. And if you're one employer and you want to try and change things, you can't really do that because you can't compete in terms of prices and everything else because of the way the system is set up. You can't compete if not everybody is doing the same thing. Last night when we were talking healthcare, I mentioned that the pharmaceutical industry is by far, in a way, the most profitable industry in the economy. And that even if they were providing affordable medication for people, providing at the same price they provided at other countries, they'd still be by far the most profitable industry. Once the expectation is out there that we deserve this rate of return on equity, no one company is going to say, oh, we're going to voluntarily reduce this and start providing our whatever for this price, or we're going to be paying this kind of wages. You can't do it on your own. You kind of need some guidelines to push we're gonna have to provide this. Should employers be the source of health care? I happen to think not, but I think that would have to happen. We have to drop that only after we've decided what we're going to replace it with, not say employers shouldn't have to, because more and more small employers are saying we can't afford it, and so they are dropping out, and that just puts more of the burden on government or the individual who can't afford to.
One advantage, though, on the other side of that argument, if the government says, granted, the real small businessman many times cannot pay, but if the larger companies can, the insurance company is more apt to get, quote, their fees from that employer rather than I as an individual, and maybe I'm on the low end and maybe I can't make my premium payment.
Oh, I agree. I mean, I think we need a universal health care system that doesn't rely on the whim or ability of an employer to provide it, but because if you believe in this social compact, which I think I certainly believe we ought to have, we do have, and we just haven't lived up to it, and I think most Americans expect, then you've got to say one way or another, yes, the poor don't have a very good health care system to Medicaid, but at least we make sure somehow or another they get some basic health care. It's the working poor who are dumped on the street, and people don't believe that that's appropriate. So if we're going to do it, we have to have a universal system that does cover everyone.
Well, on the issue of tax reform, even if you came up with a perfect tax code, inevitably, like perhaps all these little people come along looking for exemptions. And in Washington's B&O, business and occupation tax, practically has a different paragraph for each and every business in the state, giving them something other than the official rate.
I was going to say a few years ago, when we talk about how lobbying works on these issues in government, a few years ago, this political scientist wrote a book in which he claimed that lobbyist gifts and campaign contributions didn't make any impact on issues that the public really cares about, like abortion or whatever, one or two other very hot issues. It only makes a difference in little things like tax policy or banking laws, and that's exactly what you're saying. Every business comes in and says, here's why we deserve this different tax rate, this lower tax rate. They come in armed with lobbyists who are telling you, here's why, and this is actually going to save money for everybody else, and it's going to boost this. And boy, look at some other states doing this, and we're losing everybody to this state for that reason.
They don't get the papers behind them, because guess what? They don't pay sales tax when you buy the paper.
Our tax codes are a mess, and it's grossly unfair. The people who can least afford health care are the ones who pay the most taxes on it. The people who can least afford other things pay the most taxes on them, too. Oh, where is there? Tam?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about taxes, and even before we get to tax code issues, it seems to me that we've got to change attitudes in the public about what taxes are for. I've been thinking a lot about taxes the last few weeks with Congress deciding to pass this $792 billion tax break, which is based on an estimated surplus, which is predicated on $600 billion worth of
cuts.
And an economy going at the same speed that it's going now. And then I got, you know, like just after that happened, probably a week and a half later, I got my Minnesota tax rebate, which was much larger than I had anticipated. And when that passed, I thought, you know, well, at least they decided to pass it based on, you know, a sales tax rebate, so that supposedly, you know, the sales tax is regressive, so then the low-income mom should get back more than I did. But I got my little check, and it said, this sales tax rebate is based on your 1997 declared income on your income tax. I'm like, so I just got a rebate which is higher than a low-income mom with three kids who spent more in sales tax than I did. You know, and mine was undoubtedly higher than hers because it was based on my income, so it wasn't really the...
It was, well, in Minnesota, you raise a good question about tax cuts, which, again, the federal tax cuts are based on, we're going to make this many spending cuts. That means we're going to be cutting student aid, or we're going to be cutting this or that. In effect, that itself may be making the economy more regressive and less tilted towards helping people who need some help. But in terms of once you decide which cuts you're going to do, I was going to argue our sales tax rebate. First of all, you will be... If you're a single person with a certain income, it was based on family size and income and an estimate of how much those people would spend in sales tax that way. There was good reason for doing the sales tax, as you mentioned, because it's a regressive tax, and therefore getting rid of it will do that. The other advantage was federal government does not give you deductions for sales tax, so if the state was to give out for every $100 it gave out, instead of having a third of that rebate taken over by the federal government, more of it stayed in the state, which Minnesota residents should like. But the rebate system, I think the rebate portion was, at least it was better than the income taxing, but that was the one-time cut. The one-time rebate was based on the more regressive tax and therefore a more progressive rebate. The permanent tax cuts, which we gave massive ones, they were all income tax cuts, the one progressive tax we have. And I calculated, because all three parties, the governor, the Republicans were pushing for across-the-board income tax cuts. Democrats were pushing for other things but went along with it. All three parties bragged about how this bill was heavily tilted towards the middle class. Okay, because we don't want to talk about the poor, so we'll talk about the middle class. And politically, that's smart, because everybody from making from $10,000 a year to $550,000 a year thinks they're middle class. matter of fact, there was a congressman from North Carolina 2 or 3 years ago who got defeated after one term. He said... Once, several months after he got elected, that he considered himself lower middle class. Somebody said, wait, your income here in Congress is 130 some thousand a year, and you have this pension from your other job of 50 some thousand, you're getting 180, 190,000 a year? Yeah, that's lower middle class. Well, what's middle class? Oh, from about 200,000 to 700,000. I thought, you know, he's in the top 1%, 1.5%, 2% maybe of all income people, and he thought he was lower middle class. What does he think, how is he representing the people he represents who can't be, if he was in a wealthy district, more than 10% higher income than his? And there's that out of touch with things, but everybody thinks they're middle class. So saying it's heavily tilted towards the middle class taxpayers, something all three parties bragged about and said what a great bill it was. Well, I calculated the middle 50% of all taxpayers, take the poorest quarter out, take the richest quarter out, the middle half got 32% of our tax cuts. The top 15% got well over half. So 85% of the population got less than half of the tax break. And this was heavily tilted towards the middle class. I ended up being the only senator to vote against the bill, which could be risky because, you know, it's the largest tax cut in Minnesota history. But yeah, is it sustainable? We got a booming economy now, and we're saying, hey, things are wonderful. Let's cut taxes. Let's cut taxes. But we didn't address our homeless shelter needs in Minnesota. I mean, not affordable housing, just the homeless shelter needs. We had last year, our state does a survey every Thanksgiving. And of people in shelters and who's turned away from shelters. And that night, I think there were 400 people turned away from shelters, more than half of them children. Providing basic assistance to shelters, which I think 20 years ago, we didn't have homeless shelters because we didn't have homeless kids. We're now down to saying, well, we can't afford to provide a little bit more so these shelters can cover those 400 additional people that need some basic shelter. We can't afford that, but we can't afford permanent tax cuts. If we're not meeting those needs now, what happens if the economy turns sour? I think it was grossly irresponsible, and that's a long response to your comment, but our tax cuts are often far bigger than we could sustain, and they're almost guaranteed to be more regressive than they should be.
And it seems that that's something that we should even be working on in our churches, because I find that when I start talking out against these types of tax breaks, you know, even people in my own church say, but that's my money. Well, is it really their money? I mean, and I don't think that's a very biblical attitude, and yet that's always people's response. And so I think that we need to do some re-education at all sorts of levels in terms of...
The gospel scares people.
May I mention a tax that may be of interest to you and that you may like, and that's the Florida state intangibles tax. A fellow lives in Minnesota, works hard there, 70 some hours a week, 6 days a week, and tries to save a little money and invests it, they think wisely, in Minnesota municipal bonds because mm-hmm. they're tax exempt, so that when you retire, you can have that income exempt from Minnesota income tax. A person moves to Florida that does not have a state income tax, but has the intangibles tax, so those municipal bonds are taxed along with any investments that any stocks and bonds that have. Why I mentioned you may like that, because that does that certainly. If we assume that people who invest and have investments that the tax would tax against and be meaningful, if they have money. Whereas a person who's working hard in Florida and so forth does not pay that, but pays, but doesn't pay that because there's no state income tax, is what I'm saying. So that a person with a little bit moves to Florida and pays a tax and the other person doesn't. I don't know if you're familiar with the intangible taxes, but
that's pretty good.
How long would you last if you proposed that?
Well, I was going to say, these days it's kind of a matter of trying to stop, well, look at the federal and state debate on inheritance taxes. How much money should you be able to pass on to your kids tax-free? Well, now that people are billionaires, they want to be able more than the small amount of 600, whatever it was that used to be. I think it's
million
now. I wasn't too worried about it myself. But there's efforts underway to repeal inheritance taxes altogether, saying that, hey, that's mine, I earned it. It's again, I argue it's pretty unbiblical, as you said, Tammy, it's unbiblical to be talking about this being mine and therefore you can't bring it with you. Well, you can choose who gets it then. But I don't have a problem if we were to do that, as long as we had a fair tax system some other way that we take care of basic needs that we're not taking care of. And again, I still think we don't realize that if we want to bring down government costs, the thing to do is set up the structure of the economy in such a way that we require businesses to pay a living wage. It will bring down equity, rate of return on equity, but the economy can still hum along if nobody's making. If the best you can make is half what you make now, you're still going to be working stock market and investments to deal with that. And the fact that they might be paying living wages underneath that is going to save government a lot of money, and therefore taxpayers. Other comments?
But that means every taxpayer, not the ones who are for whom the tax is really slanted.
Go ahead, Bob.
You're equalizing then what you just said, which is really cool. You're paying a living wage underneath, which means you're distributing the money a little bit more equitably, as opposed to those that 2 or 3% up there who are getting who are reaping the benefits now. So it's,
right now, government in many ways, government right now is making the system more. The system tilted that way. The advantages seem to be going more and more to people who already have more,
right,
and going away from those without much. And I do think politically, there's not going to be a lot of, oh yeah, we want to put a lot more money into, okay, childcare. We do want to put more money into it. I think the polls in Minnesota say, yes, we think people who are working ought to have affordable childcare. If there's a waiting list for it, what a stupid thing it is to make them go on welfare because they can't afford childcare. Well, it's fun childcare. So people are willing to do some of that, but in the long run, politically, it's so easy to attack, quote, welfare, that we are better be looking at ways to reduce the need for welfare by affordable wage jobs. I remember going, when you mentioned earlier, going door to door, subsidized housing one part of my district. I knocked on a door and left a brochure with a little kid, and man came out the door a minute later, something in there I talked about, I supported a welfare to work proposal which had higher minimum wages, affordable child care, three or four things that would make it easier for people to move from welfare to work. Guy said, oh, I really like that. There are too many welfare bums in these houses here. All these women and their kids on welfare. And I thought, wait a minute, where are you living? And then he started talking about, well, yeah, he participated in the WIC program. That was a good program. subsidized housing. But he wasn't like these welfare bums. I thought, define welfare. It's what the other guy gets.
Yeah.
But I think politically, because of that, where even the recipient of the welfare does not like welfare and those people who get it, we have such a political climate right now that the concept of addressing it that way doesn't work. I think you have to have it by addressing the social compact. Is there anybody here who thinks you should work 40 hours a week and not be able to afford to go to the doctor when you need to go? I think that's, you can take that poll anywhere in the country, and I think you're going to find overwhelmingly people think if you do your job, you contribute to society, you ought to have enough to do these basic things. And I think they'd much rather that it comes through decent wages than through government subsidies. Mm-hmm. And I think they're consistent. I don't think they want government subsidies for wealthy corporations either. And hence the stadium talk I gave was very well populated with people, because people are angry at those subsidies.
Does anyone ever make the argument, or is any statistics been drawn, that if there was a better living wage, there might be less crime? You take it from a different angle, as far as, so then that way perhaps wealthy people could see some benefit to themselves, they might have to be have less burglar systems and be afraid of walking their streets.
I've heard that many cases used, I mean, I think there's some merit to the argument. I've heard it more often used internationally. We wouldn't have to arm our borders so much against illegal immigrants if people were able to make a decent living somewhere else. And it's definitely true, not certainly far from all crime is not economic in nature. I mean, drugs may, depends, is it drug-related burglary, is it a crime of economics, or is it a crime of drug addiction? It's probably both.
The drug's taken because of the hopelessness of the economic situation.
And clearly, if, well, I guess I happen to see a progressive idea of how we build a future. If you address chemical dependency needs, you're going to have less crime. If you address economic needs, you're going to, I mean, all you can build a society in which I think we should be striving for one where we have less and less crime, and not, oh, we're not seeing crime increases this last 5-6 years. We've actually had some overall crime decreases in this country. Despite the growing fear, our streets are a bit safer than they were 7-10 years ago. Boy, we can brag about that. We got the highest murder rate in the world. We got everything else. We're not doing very well. And certainly, I think if we address basic human needs and give people a chance, a hope, if try and tell a kid they ought to work for $6-7 at McDonald's when they can make $400 in an evening selling drugs for somebody older, 15-year-old kid, it has to have a lot of conscience to say, no, it's the wrong thing to do that. I'll work at McDonald's instead. So I think there's definitely a link there, and I happen to think we're all better off if we have a strong community. That's the nature of Holden Village. We're a community, we all help out in various ways. Whenever people say, I want my kids to have the good school stuff, I don't care about anybody else's school. Do you really want your kids growing up with kids who don't have any educational opportunities? Who, I don't think so. I think the concept of the gated community where you lock out everybody in private roads, yeah, if you want to arm yourself to the hilt in security systems, I like it here. You don't even realize nobody has any keys here.
Right.
At least take a look at Seattle, and I'm sure other parts of the country, housing is also a key issue. I mean, in Seattle now, almost one third of the house sales, houses are being sold above the asking price. Because there's a bidding war going on for housing. And to me, that has to be factored in with the growing disparity because, you know, only the wealthy can afford to live in Seattle, basically. And that means everybody else is being pushed out to other suburb communities. Costs more to come into town to work, and it's, you know, that's the market economy. And it seems to me we shy away so strongly from tampering with the market economy.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. Everybody wants to tamper with the market economy.
Put a cap on, right. You know, the cost of housing, and just put a cap on it. They can't go any higher.
You'd have, if you were to try and cap the cost of housing, I was going to say the ways we tamper with the market economy, and almost everybody, including the most rigid capitalists, favor tampering with the market economy in certain ways, shapes, and forms, especially when they're asking for some subsidy from government. I mean, we've got private businesses and small, probably conservative businesses in greater Minnesota who are begging for government help with housing right now because they can't find employees because people can't find affordable housing. And house prices in Minnesota and Midwest have been far below what they've been on the coasts, but they've been shooting up very fast. And what you say is happening there, well, we're way behind in housing costs, but they've been growing so fast. And so we have businessmen who would say, support affordable housing? Absolutely not. Why do we want to help? We already give so much welfare to those folks. All of a sudden, they're now saying, we can't find any workers. And they can see why. They're paying somebody too often $7-$8 an hour or $10 an hour. And the house prices, they can understand. You can't afford to build one. You can't afford to buy one. And they're desperate to get the workers. So they want, in a sense, that government subsidy there because we don't try and set up a system in which people will get a fair wage for their work. And frankly, those same employers are going to say, we can't afford to pay these people more. That's what the economy will bear. But I think I'd say that tampering with the economy by trying to control prices is a much, much, much more tricky sort of situation than tampering with the economy to make sure that we provide subsidies to encourage either construction of new affordable housing. I think governments around the country have been somewhat successful in provide a little bit of incentive and you can construct some affordable housing. So there are lots of ways to tamper with it, but I was going to say price control has become extremely bureaucratic and doesn't work very well.
Southern California solution seems to be transportation. They understand, other than Anaheim and Disneyland Resort area is booming and everything's booming down there right now, but they can't get the people also to support the hotel industry and the service industries that they have there with the same issue with housing. So their solution, supposedly, is knowing that the affordable housing 60, 70 miles out, they're going to design rapid transit systems to transport people in and home and back. So because there's just no place to build or to expand the housing situation out there.
I was going to say 60 or 70 miles is a long haul, at least for Minnesota area thinking, but I know Southern California has this travel everywhere.
Cars all the time.
Yeah, and And in terms of making sure people have basic necessities met, transportation is a major part of it. And we've done a poor job of setting up a public infrastructure for transportation of people. There is no good way, the jobs are not where the housing is. And in the same way 30 years ago we tried to desegregate schools by saying we're going to bus kids everywhere, why not desegregate communities instead? I think where that's been worked at aggressively, that's been far more successful than busing kids out of their neighborhoods. Let's put people in neighborhoods that way. But it's more economic segregation these days than any other kind.
Doesn't sound like there's a solution to that problem, does it? You'll probably go the way of Tim Penny.
I don't know that there aren't solutions to these. I was going to say I think there's a public will for a lot of this. I think there's not a political will. And again, as with several of my talks, I think the biggest thing, obstacle to this, indirectly causing this problem, is the money and politics issue. It really drives how we respond to issues. If you take a poll of the public, who thinks we should have some form of living wage jobs, and define living wage, but supposing you say we ought to have it where people are going to be paid $8 an hour, $10 an hour as a minimum, instead of $5 an hour. Or we're going to step in and say, if you work and your income is below this level, we will provide this level of subsidy for childcare. And it's an entitlement, like education. When you get to kindergarten age, the schools have to take you. Well, you're not school age and your parents are working, somebody's got to take you. We're going to make sure you can afford childcare. The public will support those things, but the money and politics system blocks government from even talking about that because it becomes a radical notion that just happens to be supported by a majority of Americans.
Who leads the government now but a bunch of millionaires in Congress? Legislatures get paid dollars an hour. That laws will change.
Yeah. I was going to say last night, I think it was talking about health care. I think it's more than symbolic if you say that the politicians shouldn't be able to get better health care than the worst their constituents get, because they'll guarantee their constituents get decent health care.
Mm-hmm. Also, in many of the government things that go on in Seattle, they seem to lose sight of the issue they're trying to solve, like transportation. And there's more concern about who's making money off the real estate at, say, each stop along the way, rather than how many people they're able to get off the streets and moving through the system.
Yeah. Well, I was looking at our mass transit debate in Minnesota. We were just putting in, and I'm a very strong proponent of mass transit, but I've been not supportive of light rail proposal we have in place. It's going to be a $500 million thing that I think is basically going to serve as a people mover for the Mall of America and the airport in the downtown business district. It's not really going to help the low-income people who need to get to work. It's not going to help reduce traffic congestion by more than a tiny, tiny fraction. You took the same amount of money and provided it for, I had an intern in my office last year who was at the university. Oh yeah, I could take the University Avenue bus, but that would cost me $250. Oh, I can drive cheaper than that. Can you? Not really, even if you have free parking in a faraway lot. You can't drive for cheaper than that, but you don't think about it that way. If we made bus fare 25 cents, we used to have a dime zone in the Twin Cities. Seattle had a free zone, I think, downtown. If you want to give people an incentive to do it, charge them a quarter for a bus fare, and you could subsidize that for in perpetuity with the endowment from this $500 million, that one thing. And I'll guarantee you, in a five-year period, I think with that and a couple other improvements, you could double bus ridership.
Just put a tax on downtown parking.
Parking. Well, then you got to worry about sprawl unless you're going to do it in a broader area.
In Scandinavia, the tax on fuel is like, $7 a gallon for fuel. Yeah.
All of European countries have a much stiffer fuel tax than we have.
People take the buses.
Yeah, and we have to, I put out a plan several years ago on how I think we could triple, quadruple our transit stuff. Instead, the advocates for the very expensive light rail system, their proposals would move us from what we used to be 7-8 years ago, 3% of our vehicle trips or passenger trips were done in transit. It's now down to 2.5%. I think by the time they built this mega infrastructure of light rail, it's still going to be down to 2%. I think we should be aiming 10, 20, 30% over 20, 30 years. And I think it's doable, but you have to step in and do things like fuel tax to pay for some of this. So we create the right incentives to do it. That's a regressive tax, but you have to understand sometimes you can, if the overall tax code is progressive, then you have a few regressive taxes to try and provide incentives the right way. Reduce the bus fare, increase the gas.
I think one of the things that the Americans have to change is their attitude toward living in a single family home anyway. Eventually, because if you look at Europe, the majority of the people don't live in single family housing. Mm-hmm. They live in complexes of some kind. And unfortunately for us, we're still able to do that. At least that dream that we have of living in a single family home. And the problem in Seattle here now is that we have a lot of single families still there, and they're starting to build condominiums and other things like that. But right now the condominiums are so expensive downtown Seattle. But they're still trying to build them and trying to do that. But it's going to take a long time.
Well, if we're going to talk about stewardship of our planet and I think the urban sprawl, I think you might be right about the single family house thing, but we've got a bigger problem than that. It's not single family in a house with another house a few feet away. We've got single family homes. We've got communities in the Twin Cities with zoning requirements of 5 acres per house minimum. It has to be that much if you want to build here. Think of how much land we are sprawling. I think the Twin Cities area is going, I think I heard the number eightfold in the last 40 years, which is roughly my lifespan so far. And if it goes that far in the next 40 years, what about 3 generations from now? They don't have any choices. We've swallowed up all their land with our generation's desire to do what we want. And it's sort of, you look at a community, it was in Aspen, Colorado several years ago, and you see, oh, it's a nice little community in the base of the Rocky Mountain Basin. And then a few years later, people, you know, I want to have a good view of the valley and so on, so I'll put my house up on the hill. It may wreck everybody else's. And so then you have this row of houses around there. Then the new people with the more, we want to be above them because we want the better view. And so everybody keeps doing it, we keep destroying it. In the Twin Cities area, you want to be closer to nature, so you go out there further. It used to be we all live close together, 15-minute car ride, you're out in the country. Now, 45-minute thing, and you're into the newest developments. And I think you're right about the direction of housing has to be more compact. And more compact housing doesn't have to be less comfortable. We have to rethink our concept of community. But we are about out of time. I think with the last few minutes we've been straying a little bit from the topic of income disparity, but I think many of this does tie together. And you've been attentive, and this is my last talk here, and I've enjoyed the chance to do so, and hope it stimulated some good thinking and discussions. Yes, one last comment.
Years and years ago, when I was still in high school, I can remember one thing that the sociology teacher said, and that was, if we were to take all the income and divide it out so everyone had the same amount, a few years down the road, the rich would have it back again, and the poor would be back where they were. Now, is that because, and I've thought about that, is it because they are just, they know how to handle it, and they're going to get it away from me?
I don't know if it exactly works that way. I think there would be some much wealthier people than others a few years down the road. One guy, John Rawls, I think, did a theory, just a philosopher several years ago, proposed that the way we should try and do things is what's best, how can you best help the lowest economic people in economic distribution of society. Doesn't mean if making the rich richer somehow or another brings up the bottom of the poorest of the poor, that's okay. He said that if you have to take away some from the rich to bring up, whatever you can do to bring up the base the most, because I don't think, I mean, the Soviet Union and the communist idea of economics, I don't think that brings up the base better than anything else does. In effect, it takes away all incentives to work. But why not have a system in place that assures you're going to have that base? I guess I think Rawls's theory, whether that's the right philosophy on how to deal with wealth or not, I don't know. But it seems to me, if you provide everybody a decent education, decent housing, transportation to the job, decent wages, I don't think the rich are going to suffer from doing that. And as somebody mentioned, safer communities from less crime, yeah, we're all better off if those who are least fortunate do better. I don't know how you write that into a law to do that, but I think our tax codes and other things can very easily make sure that people get a solid base. But anyway, I want to thank you for attention, and I'll be around for lunch hour yet, and look forward to, I hope, running into having our paths cross again sometime.
I hope you're coming again sometime.
I hope to.
Thank you.
Thank you.